Welcome to Catch the Flavor Youth Radio. I'm your host, Ahmed Mahmoud. With the start of September, with the start of September comes the start of the school year. And behind the groans of terror from students across the country may be more than just the dread of homework. Recent research conducted by the Canadian Institute of Health Information reported that emergency departments visits by youngsters from 5 to 24 seeking mental health or substance abuse treatment rose 63%. Hospitalizations jumped 67% between 2006 and 2016. Mental health in the education system has been a bigger issue for all people involved, not just students. This includes parents, youth lawyers, and representatives of the education system. Today, we are interviewing Judith Friedland, Professor Emerita at the University of Toronto in the Department of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy. Judith will share her experiences as a professional in the education system and observations on how that has impacted students' mental health. Professor Friedland, thank you for joining us and welcome to our show.
Thank you, Ahmed.
What might be the leading cause of anxiety and depression in youth?
I wish people really knew that answer. I don't think people really do. I think it's a constellation of factors. It's your genetic makeup, the family that you've come from, but it's also a lot to do with your experiences in life, the issues that you face, the stresses that you faced, and probably most importantly, how you've learned to cope with it and how resilient you are to dealing with what life has to offer.
Okay. What's the definition of depression, if you don't mind?
Well, there's several definitions of depression, I guess, ranging from the kind of ordinary depression that most people feel lots of times in life, when you feel down and you just feel, you know, things are a bit hopeless, but you can carry on and it's not so debilitating that you have to kind of go to bed and pull the covers over your head and you stop functioning. And I guess, you know, this is one of the ways that we really recognize when a depression is severe is because it seems so strong and because it lasts for a long time. It doesn't just disappear with, you know, friends and going out and doing things and that sort of thing. It lingers. And if anything gets worse and sadly, it, you know, can often lead people who are feeling really hopeless about everything in their past, everything in their present, and everything in their future, and then perhaps have suicidal ideation and think about taking their own lives. So it's that whole continuum. I shouldn't say continuum, because I think most people would say that a severe or psychotic depression is a different animal than an ordinary kind of everyday depression that we can all battle. So that would be a difference there.
Okay. And what are the characteristics of anxiety?
Well, I suppose in some ways that idea of how you would define what's ordinary anxiety that, again, you and I and everyone feels from time to time, and what is a really serious and debilitating anxiety. But anxiety in general is that feeling that that you can't cope, that you're afraid to go forward. You have a lot of fears about entering into new situations, meeting new people, facing that exam tomorrow, writing the paper. You know, all of those things. And it's debilitating such that you are sort of paralyzed by it and you can't keep going. And it has a lot of physical symptoms of your heart fluttering, your breathing changing, maybe sweating on your brow and so on. But again, there's the stuff that we all feel when there's something, you know, kind of heavy duty facing us that we need to do. as well as the rather different situation when it's a really serious, ongoing, long-lasting issue that makes one not able to cope. And both of these situations, when they're serious in that way, can certainly benefit from medication and, you know, really important, consistent health services.
How are post-secondary schools aiding students with mental health?
It's a great question. I guess not very well when you look at the statistics. But that, too, is a complicated question because over the years, for a lot of reasons, stigma actually has been decreasing around the issues of mental health. So it's possible that we're seeing more mental health issues because more people are coming forward. They're not as afraid to declare that they've got a problem and to seek help. So we don't know really whether that's the case in secondary, in high school, or in university, that it looks like there's more people, but we're not sure really why. However, we also know that there's so many stresses of everyday life that young people face that can put them at risk for mental health issues and serious ones. So I think, you know, their services have been bumped up, that's for sure. But there's still a very high incidence of depression and anxiety and substance abuse, for sure, drugs and alcohol. So that's a real concern in high school and in university.
Do you have any advice for people on going through these hard times?
Yeah, I do. I think I do, both because I've been around, had a few kids, a few grandchildren, and as well in my career as an occupational therapist, working clinically with people, as well as for the most part of my life as an educator at U of T, and having a lot of students come through our program and seeing them face difficult things, whether it's from you know, the stress of facing an exam and that anxiety paralyzing them in some way, whether it's the transition from one thing to another. I know you and I were just talking before that you're off to university or to Ryerson, I think, next year, we hope. And that transition of going from, you know, a high school where you've been fairly comfortable or you've grown to be comfortable. By the time you leave, you're finally comfortable in that situation. And then suddenly you go into a totally different one where you're worrying whether you're going to be up to, you know, up to doing what's going to be demanded of you. And that leads to an interesting comment, I think, about the definition of stress, which is that the demands on you exceed what your resources are. So how do we really know what resources a person has? And a lot of theorists believe, and clinicians believe, that this is all a matter of how you perceive it. If you say to yourself, oh, my God, I can't do that. I won't be able to do it. And, you know, I'm sure I'm going to screw this up. I can't manage it. Then you probably won't. But if you perceive it as something that you've handled crises like this before, maybe not the same one, but you've made, you know, gone through difficult things before and you've survived, maybe not perfectly, but it didn't kill you, you know, that you don't catastrophize this whole thing that you're facing and you sort of plod through it and figure out how to solve whatever that problem is, kind of boost your own self-esteem, that in fact you'll do better. Because the stress won't overwhelm you.
Okay.
I think you asked me something else there that I about what else students can do. Did you? Was that part of your question?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. So I think, you know, we know an awful lot about what we can all do for our mental health and our physical health. And how many of us do all of that is a different story, I guess, but we know it. I mean, we know, for example, that physical exercise, and I don't necessarily mean, you know, high-level sports or, you know, running every day or that sort of thing, but something physical on a regular basis is a great stress reducer. It's really good for your mental health, and we've always thought about it for our physical health, but it's really good for your mental health as well. Nutrition, sleep, you know, good enough sleep is important. Lots of techniques like relaxation when you're stressed, knowing how to relax your body, knowing how to relax your mind, you know, mindfulness, meditation, those sorts of techniques are really important. And I think one of the, probably one of the most important things, I think, is, and the literature proves this, is around social support, around the idea of being with other people and having relationships with people such that they can support you and you in turn either support them or support someone else. But the literature talks about three forms of support. Tangible support, where you actually do things for someone or someone does things for you, brings you a meal, you know, gives you a lift, you know, that sort of thing. Informational support, where they tell you about, you know, the resources that are out there, or they help you through writing a test or you know, looking at universities or that sort of thing. And probably most importantly, emotional support, where a person can go through life feeling loved and cared for and knowing that they can count on others should the need arise. So those three types of support become really important for a person in life generally, but certainly when they're feeling, you know, susceptible to illness or they have had illness, whether it's mental illness or physical illness. And it's important for us to try and offer that to other people as well.
And what are your views on services like Kids Helpline and Suicide Prevention Hotline?
Well, I don't know enough about how they've actually been, you know, looked at and what evidence there is about how they work. But I don't think there's any question but they should be at the top of your list when there is an issue. Certainly the Suicide Helpline, Kids Helpline, they're all going to be helpful in some level. They just may not be enough. And I think that's, you know, that's really the trick, is to be able to figure out when you need more help and when you can, you know, muddle through, or when you can go somewhere in between. You know, you can get to your, you know, your resource room at school, go to the social worker, go to the community health center, you know, like here, you know, these sorts of things. And then those people can help you move to the next level because they'll help you recognize when something is more serious and so on. So I guess the real danger is when people don't reach out at all. And that's an issue. And it's an issue for some people more than others. I think it's a bigger issue for immigrant populations because they're maybe just not used to those services, are worried about accessing them, and so on, because we do see that there's a lower use of services when people are new. And why not? I mean, that sort of makes sense. You know, why would you think that you could do that, be afraid of it, you know, worried that people might know something about you that you don't want to share or whatever. So there's a lot of work to be done there, for sure.
And how do you usually assess and, like, help students or patients?
Well, I'll stick with students to start with. I guess one big issue is to create an environment where students feel comfortable to approach someone. Maybe it's a favorite teacher. Maybe it's someone in, you know, on the health professional staff. Maybe it's, you know, the principal or someone. But that there is that sort of feeling within the school that there's no shame in all of this, that it's something that needs to be talked about and shared and prevented to the extent it can be by through that process of sharing it and so on. And then myself as an educator, I guess, you know, listening is the main tool of trying to really hear, not this, just the superficial couple of lines that a student could write on a form that would say why they needed services, but to really try to hear what all is going on, and to try and assess what what sort of things the student then needs, whether it's accommodations in the sense of, you know, delays in exams or longer time to write exams, whether it's some sort of mentoring or peer support kind of thing, learning strategist, you know, to try and figure out what the services that will help the most it would be the next step, and then to try them and to keep up that relationship so the student can come back and feel comfortable to tell you how it's going.
Okay. And what students are more likely to, like, exhibit these illnesses?
Well, that's a good question, too. I guess we could say there's so many issues that teenagers face that if you get a bunch of them kind of coming together at a time, then they're likely to exhibit some sort of mental health issues, maybe not crisis, maybe not disease, maybe not illness, but issues. So kids that maybe have always had a low self-esteem, when they are challenged by lots of other issues, that might be harder for them. They've had lack of confidence generally growing up. Family conflict that they're experiencing, stuff at home, and that's catchy almost, you know. I mean, you can't help but feel the tension that's in the air. I don't know if you've ever – do you have a dog?
No.
No. Okay. Well, if you've ever had a dog, I think the dog in a family is very quick to pick up when there's tension in the house, you know. They really can feel that. And so, obviously, kids feel it too, you know, if adults are at each other's throat. And they may be for lots of good reason, you know, people, someone's lost a job, or it's hard to make ends meet, there's other issues going on. So that puts people at risk for sure. Even the situation that we're all living in right now, you know, we've got unrest, to put it mildly, in the States, you know, south of us, all that sort of change that no one quite knows how to deal with. We've got a hurricane that was devastating that just came through, and maybe another one on its heels. You know, issues with potential war on the horizon, you know, with North Korea. So those larger issues also influence all of us, and some of us more than others, like especially those who don't have the same coping strategies, haven't built up the same support, and so on, are going to have more trouble dealing. Like, that's all going to come at them in some ways. I should look at my little list here and see. I talked about transitions. You know, looking now yourself at thinking about careers and what you're going to do and stuff like that, those are all issues that come together to make life difficult in these particular years.
Okay. And is there anything else you would like to add?
Okay. I don't know. Is there anything else you want to ask me about? I made some notes, you know, for this talk, and I guess have we got a few more minutes? Yeah. Sorry, have we got a few more minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I thought about the idea that you know, to have your own sort of personal arsenal for looking out for yourself of the things that you can do, and I've talked about some of them, you know, diversional activities are another thing. When you feel stress is really closing in on you, to be able to lose yourself in something, whether it's just a good movie or not. One of the other things that I've neglected to mention, which is really coming on the radar now, is screen time and the amount of time that people are putting, or kids in particular, are spending on their screens, which used to be spent with other people. And now they might be sitting with someone else, but that person's also on their screen. And there are now starting to emerge some studies showing higher levels of depression among kids who spend certain amounts of time on their screens. And this is something for us to really start thinking about, that it's an unhealthy pursuit. It makes you think maybe that you've got friends, you know, and who's liking you and so on. But, you know, people then are looking at those metrics and saying, oh, am I really liked? And, you know, this sort of thing that's really not healthy. So that whole thing has to get controlled too. So I think, you know, my bottom line would be to say you really, you know, you want to be safe rather than sorry about any of this, that if you're worried yourself or you're worried about a friend, then you really want to seek help for yourself or help your friend to seek help. And I think that's really important rather than to leave someone to be isolated or to allow yourself to be isolated, to have that community sense that we're all in this together, and fortunate to have a place like this community health center here that you can access, or schools that have services and so on, and to take advantage of them.
Do you have any advice for people that are around the people with these disorders?
Yeah. I think the idea of stigma that has been is being challenged, you know, programs like the Bell Let's Talk that have been out there, that high-profile people talking about depression, you know, the sportscaster Michael Landsberg going around talking about his depression and so on, that really helps people going through those things to not feel so alone. And I think it's everyone else's job around a person going through an illness like that to be a good friend and to be a support and to, you know, mental illness isn't catchy. There's no reason to stay away and to be there for them and to be helpful.
Okay. Thank you, Professor. And thank you for, you know, your notes.
Okay.
And thank you so much for being on here. Stay tuned for the next half hour, where we will continue the topic of mental health in the education system.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Speak.
he got like the wrong pill?
Maybe he took the wrong pill.
Welcome back to Catch the Flavor Youth Radio here on Radio Regent. If you're just joining us, we just wrapped up an interview with Professor Judith Friedland on mental health in the education system. Next, we will have audio clips from some speakers from last night's Why Should I Care panel discussion. Why Should I Care is a Toronto-based grassroots civic engagement system. They are a group of people who come together to discuss thoughts and concerns in a safe, nonpartisan environment on current issue topics, usually once a month. This month, they focused on mental health in the education system with four speakers from different perspectives to share their insights. Our first speaker is Tammy. Tammy is a parent with twin boys who experience mental health issues, and she tells her personal journey dealing with her children in the education system and how that has impacted her children, herself, and her family. Take a listen to her story.
This is a completely 100% volunteer-run organization, and we try to put on these volunteers. This is a completely 100% volunteer-run organization, and we try to put on these events every month. And what we're trying to do is get tonight. We want to do things a little differently tonight. And she's going to tell her story. Her name is Tammy, about trying to get resources, mental health resources, for her two children in the public education system.
That first year, it started with little things. You know, I would go to pick them up, and I would be, you know, I'm a first-time mom, you know, I've got my boys. And how was their day? Well, he did nothing. He sat on there, he sat on his ass, he did nothing all day. He did it all negative. Okay, maybe we could not say that in front of my son. But, okay, so then go to the next room. How was it? Well, I don't know. He didn't come into the classroom. He sat at the back all day. Why did he sit at the back all day? Well, because he had these things that he was picking up. So things started to happen where I started to get red flags that one of my sons was suffering from OCD. And so one of the things that he did was he would pick up garbage, all garbage, coffee cups, dirty diapers, straws, you name it. And he would anthropomorphize them. So they had personalities. So this is a mental health issue. And he absolutely was incapable at 8 years old of self-regulating to the point where he could let that go. He would get made fun of on the school grounds. He was unable to participate in the classroom activities because he was unable to take the paper towel or the leaf out of his pocket. Okay? So instead of working with that, which we did at home, he didn't bring the garbage into the house. We had a box at the front door, and it worked that he would empty his pockets at the front door and then go in, and we could have a perfectly civilized evening. So we were working with this, having no background whatsoever in children's psychology, mental health. I'm just a parent. I'm not a teacher. I'm not a psychologist. I just love my kid. So what's going to work here? Do I yell at him? Do I take away his privileges? Do I give him a sticker chart? This is about as good as our system gets. So ABA therapy, it's all about rewards and punishments, consequences and rewards. That's it, folks. I have looked. This is the system that is out there. It doesn't matter what modality you're looking at. Rewards and consequences are what we're focused on. It didn't work. So if something doesn't work, we need to find another way. The school system didn't see it that way. We're going to try the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. I'm here to tell you, if my kids could have done the things that they was expected of them, they would have done it. I had to say, no, I believe my kid is a good kid. I was given advice like, put them in a timeout. Okay, so my kid is 9. He's close to 100 pounds. Okay, so what I would say, what do I do if he just comes out of the room? You get a 2x4. I'm not kidding. I can't make this stuff up. You get a 2x4 and you nail it to the door. This is the advice I'm getting from the school board. The first team meeting that we had when my kids were 5, we sat around a table. What seems to be the problem? We've got a speech pathologist, a social worker, a vice principal, a principal. It's a pretty intimidating environment as a parent, first-time parent, who thinks their kids are just wonderful. And suddenly you get a notice at home that says they're going to have a meeting with or without you. says that explicitly on the form, which, of course I'm going to be there. My husband and I are both there. I kept saying, what seems to be the problem?
Well,
the woman was English.
He won't come to the carpet.
And I'd say, but he's five. You've never experienced this before? I've never seen such a lack of regard for authority in all my career. So I said, oh, okay. So this is the problem. So I go out and I buy a whole bunch of books. And I get a PhD on this subject. And then I go back and I say, you know what? I'm reading this great book. And all these resources that I'm sorry, but this is a lot of money being spent. And we're lining up. The parents are lining up for these meetings. There's, you know, as I said, social workers, speech pathologists, you know, six-figure people in this room. And I'm suggesting books, and they're writing them down. They're thinking, oh, this sounds like a good resource. Oh, they have no clue how to interact with me, what to, you know, strategies, nothing. This is all new to me. I had never heard the words ADHD, autism spectrum disorder, nothing. I become an expert on this, and particularly an expert on my kids. So who would be the best person to go to sort of strategize about how we can help a kid, this kid? The parent, right? Especially a parent like me. But instead, I was viewed as an adversary, annoying, roll the eyes, here she comes again kind of person. And the whole time, I'm wondering, what do I do with my kids? What do I do? So I get the call that comes every single day. Come and pick up your kids. We don't know what to do with your kids. Come and pick up your kids. So I go to the bank. I'm in the bank lineup. And I say, I'm crying. And I say, the woman says, hi, how are you today at the Royal Bank? And I'm, you know what, I'm not so good. I don't know what to do with my kids. And this woman is about 22 years old. And she says, just love them. I said, really? She said, yeah, just love them. Okay. I have no other resources at this point except the bank teller. So I walk in and I just love them, and it was the best decision I could have made. Protect the relationship with your children at all costs. That's what's going to get the kids through this mental health. Their mental health issues that are a result of, in my personal opinion, a direct result of the discrimination, the marginalization, the pathologizing of these kids so that they're not actually human beings anymore. They're just a number and they're a nuisance, quite frankly. If they're not going to score on their EQOAs, they're a nuisance. We got resources for them. We'll give them, you know, support people, which we got. We got a support person. If I told you the history of this support person, in fact, you know what? I think I might just tell you a little bit about it. So I get an odd feeling about this support person. It's Thanksgiving. I Google his name. And because it's public record, up comes his rape conviction. You think I'm lying. I can't make this up. So the person that's in charge of my son, who has emotional regulation issues, we've established that, he, you know, is separated from all the rest of the kids, et cetera, is now being looked after by a convicted rapist. I can't make this up, okay? So there was a loophole in the union, filed a grievance, got his job back. Still convicted of rape. Rape of a 21-year-old convenience store worker. He got reinstated and got placed with my kid. This is the guy that's supposed to teach my kid all the things that go along with mental health and coping in a system. That's just one story. I could tell you 20 that are equally as dramatic and shocking and flabbergasting. And then you've got a family that's in crisis that's supposed to support their children. To say that we were overwhelmed would be an understatement. So where are the policies? Where does policy come into all of this? Where do resources and help and therapy and assessments, where does it all come in? Well, we did it all. My husband and I did it all. We have a file this thick on our kids, and we homeschool them now. So that's just cutting to the chase, that nothing worked. In fact, not only did nothing work within the system, but then when we decided that we would spend $30,000 a year and go private, everything was going swimmingly. We'd gone to 3 different interviews. The kids had had their visits. The teachers had all met my kids, et cetera, et cetera. And then the OSR showed up. and suddenly they wouldn't return our phone calls. Because in that OSR are labels and descriptions that I've never seen, but I can tell you it wasn't favorable. And suddenly we can't get into a private system. These are good kids. These are kids that will likely be lawyers and teachers themselves when they grow up. They're academically on par. Do they have some issues? Absolutely. When you find your kid in the bathroom at 8 years old with a crowbar and a piece of string trying to hang himself, there's some issues going on. Because the world would be better off without me, mommy. So you call CAMH and you say, we got a problem. Well, first they have to have this and this and this and this and this. And then you go to the doctor and they say, well, just put them on this and this and this and this. And then you look up the side effects of these particular drugs and you go, how am I going to know if this is a side effect or if this is an actual issue? So for me, the best choice was to not medicate, which is, I'm not saying people can't medicate, but that was our family's choice. And I'm giving you 5 years of basically hell, which I now, my husband and I both, I'm convinced, suffer from PTSD. If you Google autism spectrum disorder, school systems, PTSD, you will get a ton of hits because parents now are literally suffering. Every time my phone rings, I think it's a school and my kids are homeschooled. But it's this reacting of the absolute crisis that our family was under. And they're not helping my kids. Now our family's in crisis. Who's going to help the kids? And at the end of the day, that is what is important. Where these little kids, and these aren't numbers. My kid has blonde hair with blue eyes, and I would take my kids' pictures and I would put them in the middle of the table while we spoke about them. Because these aren't statistics, these aren't numbers. As you can see from my tears, these are the most important people in my entire life. And they're getting no help from the system whatsoever.
The next speaker is Jane Stewart, a litigation lawyer with the organization Justice for Children and Youth. Jane is an experienced and dedicated advocate who is passionate about assisting young vulnerable people and promoting youth and child rights. She shares her experience as a lawyer dealing with youth and the links between the education system, mental health, and the law. Take a listen.
My name is Jane Stewart. I'm a staff lawyer at an organization called Justice for Children and Youth. We are a legal aid funded clinic or specialty clinic that serves children and youth exclusively. So my clients are all young people under the age of 18. We do also have a street youth legal services program for homeless and unstably housed youth up to the age of 25. The vast majority of the work I do is for children and youth under the age of 18. So we offer services in a wide variety of areas of law that affect children and youth, and oftentimes those are intersecting. So education law is a large portion of the work that we do. We also do youth criminal justice work, so criminal law, criminal defense work, human rights, mental health. So mental health, as you might have guessed, intersects with many different areas of the law. There are specific rights under the Mental Health Act, and we can provide advice and services to young people specifically with their rights within that system. But mental health issues also arise in the education system, in the child welfare system, in the youth criminal justice system, and all kinds of combinations of all of those systems. So education services that we provide, we can provide them directly to a young person or to a pupil at school. But under the Education Act, a lot of the rights and the procedural protections for children and families actually belong to parents. Parents are the ones that can that are the rights holders under that act. Generally, the approach we try to take is a children's rights-focused approach, so ensuring that children are at the center of any decision-making that's happening. I think a lot of times our clients find that in any system that they're in, whether that's the education system, the criminal justice system, the mental health system, or the child welfare system, there's a lot of adults who are making a lot of decisions and having some very adult conversations that affect their lives in pretty significant and profound ways. And a lot of times they're not consulted as part of those decisions. So the way that we offer our advocacy and our services is to try to give a voice to children in any kind of decision-making that's being made about them. So we bring that approach and that perspective and lens to the education work that we do. So education work we do generally falls into one of three categories, and I would say that mental health is a significant part of each of them. So the first one is the right to attend school. So the Education Act provides a right for every student in Ontario to attend school, and a responsibility on every parent to ensure that their child is enrolled in the school. Unfortunately, a lot of times, or sometimes, a mental health issue can be a major barrier. Either a child doesn't want to attend school because they've got some mental health struggles that are keeping them out of the school system, or sometimes you find that a school, and this is certainly Tammy's experience, a school misunderstands a mental health issue, or can't properly support or won't properly support a mental health issue. And unfortunately, as a result, we'll make a decision that a child can't attend school. So that's a major area of advocacy for us. The second area where we find, or where we do education work, is in special education. So Deborah mentioned a lot of the ways that a child can receive special education services. You first have to be identified as exceptional. There's a body called the Identification, Placement, and Review Committee, which makes decisions about whether a child can be identified as exceptional, and if they are identified as exceptional, what's the right placement for them? Should they be in a special education classroom? Should they be in a normal, in a regular classroom with supports in place, or spend part of their day in a special education classroom? There's a lot of different. There's some flexibility there. Unfortunately, if they don't fall into one of those categories, as oftentimes happens with mental health, where sometimes the issues that a young person is experiencing aren't always visible and aren't always easily identifiable. So in those situations, the school still has an obligation to assist and to support that student and to accommodate them to ensure that they are able to have a meaningful access to the same education that other students have. So the language, or the Supreme Court of Canada has recognized that those accommodations are, you know, it's akin to someone with a physical disability having a ramp to, you know, get up a set of stairs and into the school. So special education and mental health supports are like that ramp. They're what allows somebody who may be having some sort of mental health struggle or an identifiable mental health disability access the same services in a meaningful way. So then the last area that we provide services in, or that we often see students giving us a call about, is discipline. So under the Education Act, a lot of people don't realize that when a student is either suspended or expelled from school, there's a lot of procedural rights that attach to that. So there's appeal rights, there's a duty of fairness that the school board has to ensure that any process that they use to remove a child from the school environment is a fair one, and they have a right to be heard in that process. And the school also has an obligation to consider what are called mitigating circumstances under the Act. And what might be a mitigating circumstance is the fact that this is a young person who, whatever conduct has led to the disciplinary measures, may well be tied to a mental health struggle that particular young person is experiencing. And that is something that needs to be taken into account by the school, both under the Education Act and under the Ontario Human Rights Code at the same time. So a lot of the advocacy work that we do is ensuring that those factors are properly understood and properly taken account of in any disciplinary decisions that are being made with respect to a child. And you can also imagine that there are a number of intersections with the criminal justice world. So sometimes we see that, you know, kids with mental health issues certainly are more engaged in the criminal justice system than kids that don't have mental health issues. So as a result of that, you know, a kid with a mental health struggle may become involved in conduct that leads to a criminal charge, then also leads them to be expelled from school. So they've lost that protective factor, that community that can be a real support for them. So that's another area that we advocate in for children and young people. part of the work that we do is at the clinic is public legal education. So sessions like this, we provide education and information directly to young people, to parents, to teachers, to other service providers.
Patricia, our next speaker is Patricia Mara Stapleton. Patricia Mara Stapleton is a mental health leader for the Toronto District Catholic School Board. She has worked for 19 years with the school board as a psychological associate and shared with us her observations and experience in this role in an evolving school system and how it has tried to incorporate issues of mental health into it. Take a listen.
I'm here to give you an insight as to what's happening in Ontario in regards to student mental health. So I've worked in a variety of areas of mental health. I've worked in juvenile justice, child welfare, children's mental health, community health. And all of those areas have a commonality, and that is complex kids with complex issues in a complex situation. So there sadly are no easy fixes. But I think one of the things that we have to wrap our minds around, both as a community, so we're all in that community together, and as an educational system, is shifting our thinking from what is currently downstream thinking. So downstream thinking is waiting till a problem occurs, exacerbates itself, permeates itself to a level that can't be retracted. So that's downstream thinking, getting activated when all the bells are ringing. And we need to shift to what we like to think of as upstream thinking, preventative, proactive, laying the groundwork towards health. Because each of our kids have mental health, just like they have physical health. Same with you and me. I have mental health, so do you. If I'm ill, maybe I have a mental illness. And even that said, I can still be ill and be generally healthy. That doesn't preclude my functionality or your children's functionality. So we have to back things up towards an upstream kind of thinking. So in school boards across Ontario, as of 2012, mental health was injected in a way that was never seen before. Often, and I've been on both sides of the fence, both on the inside and the outside, before this point in time, mental health was seen as not the school's business. We don't deal with that. We don't treat that. We don't intervene in that. We don't know about that. And that's changing, because now our Ministry of Education sees mental health and well-being as very much the responsibility of schools and school boards. Not to treat everything and be everything to every child, because, again, we're a community. So school boards are encouraged to think of mental health and well-being in what's called a tiered approach. And that's how we approach education. It's how we approach safe and accepting schools. So if you think visually of a triangle, the bottom base of the tier of the triangle is the heftiest. It's got the most territory and real estate. And that's our tiered one, or universal area, where in the classroom we need to make mental health as relevant as physical health. So our kids in schools are being taught daily physical activity. They're being taught about germs and how to be clean and how to be safe and how to cough in your elbow. We never used to cough in our elbow in school. We used to cough in our hands, right? But we don't do that anymore. And ask any school-age kid why that is, and they can easily rhyme off why that is and why it's important for them to be a part of keeping us all physically healthy. So we're starting the work in Ontario of making each school kid aware of just that, how to keep ourselves mentally well and mentally healthy, just as they understand physical health. And that might seem like a pretty innocuous, simple thing, but until and unless we start to make that infiltrate every avenue of schools, the stigma around mental health will increase. And I know that's one of the things that we wanted to talk about this evening as well, is how can we as a community combat that so that we're not sent home and we're not told you're not okay to play with on the playground because you're doing something that looks a little unusual, right? The middle tier is what we call preventative care, and that's when we start to see emerging areas that could be problematic, and what can we do in a concerted way to intervene on that tier two, where something's kind of emerging, we don't know what's going on, but can we put some supports in place, and school boards have supports, to mitigate it from becoming a downstream problem. Now, the top of the triangle is generally the smallest part. It's the tip of the triangle, the tip of the iceberg, as it were. And that's where we have intensive services that are needed. They're identified, they're indicated needs for some children that might be showing those emerging mental illness issues. More nuanced, more intensive, and more high needs. Now, we work with our community partners in serving that aspect of the tier, because in school boards, we provide brief intervention. We don't provide ongoing clinical therapeutic care. We're not set up that way, and we're not funded that way, but our community resources are. So we're working with them in tandem to create a system, as it were, because our triangles are the opposite. We do a lot of preventative and promotion, but the community does a lot of that intervention, that really direct intensive services. So if we work together, and the ministries of education and ministries of community and social services and children and youth services are working on that very task, not an easy shake by any stretch of the imagination. And what gets me a lot, and since we're talking about, you know, what kind of gets to us, is how mental health is funded. Not only in Ontario, but in Canada. So rough numbers. Health is funded, say $1,000 per person, rough number. For every $1,000 that's funded for your physical health, and we would all agree that's important, but mental health is funded $1. Just to give you a rough perspective. So we can't do the same with less, but we're constantly asked to do just that. In our schools, our teachers come to work every day. They're not mental health practitioners. They're not mental health experts. They're not trained that way. Their training isn't designed that way. But yet, we need to help them understand in their perspective, what does mental health or mental illness look like in the classroom? And we're doing that on a daily basis across Ontario, across school boards, most like myself as well. We use resources that have been developed by the Ministry of Education in consultation with experts in mental health. One such resource is Supporting Minds, an educator's resource guide to teachers K through 12 about mental health for students. Kind of what's the look for? What does this look like? When maybe a student might need supports? And what are some universal strategies in the classroom, universal design, that can really tip the scales towards health? We're not asking them to counsel the kids, we're not asking them to be the school psychologist, but be on the front line knowing what we're seeing and what kinds of universal strategies we can put into place to make a difference upstream so we don't get downstream. Because there is no way we're going to treat ourselves out of this. I would love to be able to hire more social workers, hire more psychologists. I wish that we could all pass a hat and everybody pitch in. But we can't treat ourselves out of this. We have to think about it in a different way. And thinking about it in terms of prevention, promotion, health, and making it very evident that it's all of our business. It's not just the way that it used to be in education. And I think it's taken us a while in Ontario to come to understand it's a partnership. They don't go down the hall to get fixed. It has to look a lot different for it to get a lot better. So that's just to give you a little snapshot of where we are and where we're going. Lots more to do.
Thank you to our guest, Judith Friedland, for sharing her insight. Thank you to Why Should We Care's and guest panelists Tammy, Jane Stewart, and Patricia Mara Stapleton for giving us different perspectives on the issue of mental health and the education system. We hope you learned something valuable from this evening's show. That's all the time we have for our show. Thank you for tuning in to another series of Catch the Flavor Youth Radio here on Radio Regent. Be sure to catch us next time when we will be back with this, back at the same time and same place, Tuesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Please stay tuned because coming up next is Murphy Brown.